Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, Hotel Aladdin is very proud to welcome back the star of the Baghdad Theater. Let's have a warm welcome for Mr. Godfrey Cambridge.
Yeah! Hi, everybody. Are you having a good time here in Las Vegas? That's the spirit, all winners. That's what I like to see. I heard a couple of bitter laughs over there. Come right in. Make yourself at home there. Just step right there. This is what is known as good race relations. Like to dress. Very nice. I like to see white people in colorful clothes. It takes the pressure off of us. Well, all I got to do is put on a red shirt, man. Everybody says, look at that. See that? I told them people like bright colors. I'm basically conservative. I also say drink up because I encourage white people to get drunk because it also takes the pressure off of me. You get drunk, they just say, you're drunk. I get drunk, I blow it for a whole race. Say that, see that, Mary, right out the south. Don't know how to act, I told you that. And the way I'm going, I've lost so much weight, my clothes get so baggy every day, I hope to God my pants never fall down, you know. See that, Mary, I told you they're oversexed. Look at that, his pants fell down in his act. My God, those people are awful. Oh, Vegas is a friendly town, you know. It's wild, though, because it turns you around. I mean, there is no night, there is no day here. I regard this town as Sodom and Gomorrah West. And it's the goodness, you know, I come from a conservative West Indian family. I was raised to believe that anybody who was out after 12 o'clock at night was either a dope seller or a white slave. And it seems immoral to me, you know, to go to bed at 6 a.m. in the morning, get up at 4 and walk through the casino and say, good morning, good morning. Time stops here. How many of you people out there have bought the same newspaper twice? Been ashamed to take it back, haven't you? Bought you there, right? No, time does not exist here, you see. And the interesting thing about it is, I don't know anything about gambling, you know. I take my girlfriend out, you know, I say, go ahead, honey, bet $100. If you lose, I'll make it a racial issue. You can file that under the heading, Fat Chance. No, I don't know anything about gambling. I don't gamble myself. If it's not a moral conviction. It's just that I figure, why the hell should I spend my time learning a game that will only take my money away from me? So I have never lived up to my ethnic responsibilities, folks. I have never learned how to shoot craps. And they've tried to teach me, you know, they kept me out there every now and then, you know, they say, hey, throw the dice, you know. And I make a spectacle of myself because I end up saying, this is a ridiculous game. Look at the odds. The customer can never win. That thrills the pit boss. Says to my manager, would you get your client out of here before I break his head? But you know, another thing is, bosses are a little obvious too about wanting you to gamble. You know what they do to me? When I was working up at Lake Tahoe, I'd get paid, and every pay night, I would take my check and I'd put it in a stamped, self-addressed envelope, and the boss would follow me all the way to the mailbox. He'd say, Mr. Cambridge, you want to have a party down at my house, play cards? We'll have beautiful girls, pretty girls, white girls. That's the ultimate. And I drop my envelope in the mailbox and I say, what about the girls? He say, what are you, miscegenationist? Oh man, they're a little obvious. They're really kind of wild. And you know, I have seen people here so hung on gambling that they get off a plane and walk right past their loved ones straight up to a slot machine. Hi, Ma. How long you been in the wheelchair? Dad died. Was it quick? I mean, this is the only town where they even have slot machines in the John. It's the only town in the world where a guy can go spend 3 hours in the John. Nobody gets suspicious. So yeah, Dad had a hot machine. Oh, really? I know one guy got hung on slot machines. And he got drunk in New York one day. He'd just gotten back from Vegas. He got smashed out of his mind and he went into the automat and got a fistful of nickels. Man, and he just started putting in those nickels and turning dials. Man, the food was all over him, all over the floor, pies, milk, everything. And the manager came over and said, what the hell are you doing?
And so what's the matter? You mad because I'm winning?
No, it's really insanity. So I don't gamble, you know. And of course, later on, you're going to see our topless band, which is really a magnificent attraction we have here. Oh, it's beautiful. You know, and these, you don't laugh, fellas. These girls have, they've been carrying on in the great tradition of show business that the show must go on. Because one of them had a terrible accident last night, the cymbal player. Oh, I tell you, to see one of those things with a flesh-colored band-aid is ridiculous. But all of the shows are topless here, and, you know, we live in a breast-oriented culture, right? And I guess as young men, we've all had those bare bosom fantasies. And now your average stay in Vegas is 3 days. I'm here for a full month. I tell you, after I've seen about my fifth topless show, I begin to say to myself, am I homosexual? Honest to God, if you really want to get turned off, go watch those chicks at that 5:30 a.m. topless show when they've been dancing all night. They'll shake themselves to death. You want to say, honey, if you're not going to use that thing, put it away. You're gonna be a good group. We're recording this one for my mother. So I want you all to be very nice to me because she's a critic for Muhammad Speaks. Sarah X. Nice Jewish girl who went wrong. You know, maybe, you know, I think of all the topless things, you know, and I was reading an article about the population explosion today, you know, and the fact that the pill isn't really working, you know. Because, like, sometimes she forgets and drives the guy up the wall. Oh, I forgot. Oh. What do you mean you forgot? It's a final control they still maintain, right? Maybe what we ought to do to cut down on this population explosion, maybe we ought to change the sexual objects in our society. Maybe we ought to make them something new, like elbows. And we'll only tell a few hip, well-bred people where it's really at. And the rest of the squares will say, yes, it's elbows. Can you see some idiot guy in Paris picking up some dirty picture postcards with pictures of scantily clad elbows on it? And of course, little Boy Scouts could never help little old ladies across the street anymore by grabbing them by the elbow.
I got you, lady, you sexy 80-year-old, you. Past puberty.
And, of course, putting your elbows on the table would definitely be obscene. I have a sick mind. Oh, I had a good day today. I really got up, you know, and the only bad thing that happened to me was I played my first game of golf. They finally got me out in that damn field to play golf, folks. And I hate it, because I don't drink. So I figure, all right, I'll go out with these idiots on the field. You know, I figure I can loosen my tie. No, you can't do that. You gotta buy the full outfit. You know, with the little alligator on the shirt. I mean, a naked chick on a necktie, all right. But who needs a sissy alligator? So I go out, I buy a Ben Hogan hat, Ben Hogan shirt, Ben Hogan pants, and I played like Ben Gurion. And this idiot, you know, he says, you're gonna take lessons, he said, have you ever played golf when you were a boy? I said, oh, yeah, man. I played in the Harlem Open. Played the Southside Chicago Classic. You know, all those wonderful games, you know. And the guy says to me, come on over to the bar. I'll introduce you to the pro. There she was, sitting at the bar. Oh, it's wild, you know. And I came across the avenue here.
And, you know, I'm beginning to think I'm accident-prone, you know. Because I walked across the strip here in the afternoon, and some idiot nearly knocked me down and yelled out, I didn't see you! Big and black as I am, he didn't see me? I even had an accident in Beverly Hills. I was driving home one night from work about 4 a.m. in the morning, and I want to make a left turn. That's legitimate, right? And I signal for a left. I even stick my hand out the window. and a chick comes by driving a car and totally demolishes the rear end of my car. So I got out of the car. I guess I looked a little hostile, perhaps. A little perturbed, perhaps. And the first thing she said to me was, "Ah, I'm married to a colored fella." True story. So I said, "Okay, you get 10% off in the suit." And you know she was married to a colored fella? I said, "I'm walking in a bar and this 9'6" Watusi walks up to me. He says, "Hey, baby, I understand that you ran into my old lady." I said, "Yes, I put it in reverse." "Lovely girl." "I called the cab for her." "Black and black together, we shall overcome." And I kissed him. Oh, God. I am a coward, folks, believe me. Oh, my God. The things that happen to me, strange, weird. Of course, and now, you know, I don't know whether you notice or not, but I have lost a total of 120 pounds. Oh, thank you. I was a fat mother. Now, I tell you, man, I lost the equivalent of 10 Twiggies. I always have a nightmare of going to bed with Twiggy and getting bone bruises. But that's another story. But now that I've lost all this weight, man, I am turned on to clothes. Because, you know, when you're a 54 regular face, there's very little they can do for you in the way of style. I mean, they can keep you from getting arrested for nakedness, but that's it. So now that I'm a 43 regular, I'm having fun, man. I'm buying clothes every day. And you know what I found out? The shops that I like, the men's shops that I really dig, are those little men's specialty stores that are usually opened up by two guys who decide to give up life in the chorus and settle down together, measuring inseams. I mean, they're great for your ego. Because when you walk in there, man, the guy comes over like this. And I don't know whether he's gonna wait on me or ask me to dance. And what's more, he's so pretty, I don't know what I'm gonna do. Except that I'm not programmed that way. You know, I walk into those stores and the guy says, "May I measure in seam?" And I said, "No, I need a sweater." He says, "It doesn't matter." Oh. Of course, now, you know, that I've lost a lot of weight, I have been doing motion pictures, and that is the greatest fun of all. Because I've always wanted to do pictures, and now it's a good time to be doing pictures because they're changing the Negro image in films, you know. Because for years, you know, when I was a 10-year-old kid, I would go to the movies, and I'd be embarrassed, man, because there's always a guy in the movie named George or Sam, and he was Negro, and he was always about 10 feet tall, about 300 pounds, and he was always being whipped by Massa, who was 2'6", 30. And I'd sit there saying, "Oh, baby, you are a drag." Either that or they had us in those prison pictures because they liked that soft, sweet singing, you know. "Oh, Jesus! Oh, Lord!" And the only cat that I could really respect in those movies was Jimmy Cagney. I dug him because he was a man. You know, he was always on death row and he was always screaming. He's always saying something like, "You fools will never get me in a death house!" And I was always in the next cell going, "Oh, Jesus!" I was really going at it, you know. "Oh, Lord, save your soul. Oh, Jesus." And you want to say, "What is this jackass singing for?" He's going tomorrow. So now it's exciting, man, because, you know, I just finished a picture about a month ago, a couple of months ago, called Bye Bye Braverman. And in it, I play a Jewish cab driver. I even did a picture called The President's Analyst with James Coburn. And this is his co-production. It's for Paramount. And it's a gas, because I dig, you know, like the stars who put their money where their mouth is, you see, because every time we have a march in Mississippi, you see, we always get about 30, 40 stars, man, and they charter a jet plane, and they fly down to Mississippi. That costs $50,000. Now, that's wasted money anyway, you know. Send the money. You don't have to come, yeah. Because they go up there, man, and as they get on the plane, they're saying, is Life magazine going to be there? They're going to take my picture, you know. And they get down there to march the last 8 feet. Because they ain't going to strain themselves, you know. And they get off that plane reeking of colognes, wearing mohair Levi's, with specially arranged versions of We Shall Overcome by Hank Mancini and Quincy Jones. See the Martian, We Shall Overcome, yeah. And off they go. You never see them again. So Jimmy Colbert, man, did this picture, the president's analyst, and he used me in it. And guess what? I play a CIA agent, and I kill people. Ching! Now that's progress. For our side, though. And you know, the picture opens up. Picture opens up on 7th Avenue in the Garment Center, New York City in the 40s. And I'm in disguise. I'm wearing a James Brown wig. You know, with all the curls. Are you hip to processed hair? All right, I have to explain it to you folks. See, now, processed hair, whenever you see a Negro cat with all those, you know, curls on his hair, you know, it looks like he's been to a hairdresser or something, that is caused by the fact that a lot of Negroes have been brainwashed into believing that their hair is no good, that their hair must be soft. May I touch you, sir? I don't want you to think I'm funny. I'll meet you at the bar later. But why should my hair be soft like that man's? It doesn't have to be, you know. I'm not gonna cut my hair and knit a silk scarf, you know. I mean, there's nothing wrong with my nappy, kinky hair, you see? And processing is so much trouble. You know how they process? They take potash and they mix it with olive oil and cheap perfume, and it's so strong that they have to put it on with rubber gloves. And man, now this is to straighten the hair, you see? And man, you put that stuff on your head, and it is so strong that the hair just gives up. I mean, it is strong enough to straighten out the coils on a hot water heater. And you can only leave it on for about 5 minutes, then you gotta put water on it. And the quickest way to get stomped to death, baby, is to get between a guy with that stuff on his head and the water tap. Because you heard of the hot foot? Well, that's where the hot head came from. So like there I am in my James Brown wig and I'm wearing my Dizzy Gillespie for President sweatshirt and a pair of suntans and I'm pushing this dress cart down 7th Avenue and the plot is that I'm supposed to stab this Albanian agent, secret agent, and dump him in my cart, you see? So I'm just going down the avenue and I stab him to death, dump him in the cart, and we're shooting with hidden cameras so nobody really knows what's going on. And it's an interesting comment on our society that we have pictures on film, you know, of guys who saw what went on and are standing there like this looking at each other and they're saying, did you see anything? I didn't see anything. So a Schwarzer killed a fellow, why do we care? So what? We won the Wailing Wall, don't worry about it. It's true, nobody in our society wants to get involved anymore. I have a button that says, God is alive, he just doesn't want to get involved. He's in the White House. So I've been having fun, man, making pictures. I made another one over in Italy and called The Biggest Bundle of Them All, which had nothing to do with my original size. And, you know, it was a thrill, because I like to learn about other people, other races, other cultures, you know, and I'd never been over to Italy, and so I decided if I was going over, I was not going to be an ugly American, you see. So I decided I was going to learn the language, you know, with the Berlitz records and the little phrase book. And I'm practicing like crazy, man. I go over on the plane, I'm going over, I'm practicing. And they told me when you land in Rome at Fiumicino Airport, they said, look for a little Italian guy with a sign with your name on it. So I land at Fiumicino Airport, and I'm proud of my Italian, you know, and I walk over to this little Italian guy with the sign with my name on it, and I say, buongiorno, signor, come stai? Bene, mi piace Italia, io voglio mangiare adesso. And he said, hi, yo, baby, welcome to Roma. He's from the south of Italy. And later on, you know, I'm still trying, you know, and they put us to stay at a hotel called the Parco de Principe, and I didn't know that that's where all the Americans stay, so I'm still trying to speak my Italian, so I get the operator on the phone, and I say, telefonista, per favore, io voglio telefonare Cinecittà Studio, 86, and the operator said, Mr. Cambridge, we're very busy, baby, what number do you want? Man, you're in, you know, it's like emasculation, it's humiliation, right? So the next morning, I get up,
And they take me to this little village where we're making the film in the south of Italy. It's called San Giorgio. Very small town. And I'm staying in the best hotel in town, but they don't have a lot of the wild things we're used to, you know, like a lot of soap and extra towels and stuff. I see you've been. And, you know, I don't want to be an ugly American, but I've been there 3 weeks now, and I figure if I don't get a clean towel pretty soon, I'm going to be a dirty American. So I call down to the desk, and I say, "Hey, desk!" I didn't have a telephone either, folks. And they're not about to change their way of living for me, you know, so I end up playing little tricks with the chambermaid to try and trick her into giving me a clean towel, you know. Like after I finish bathing, I jump on it and do my little African war dance on it, dirty shoes and all, you know. And I come and I leave it under the bed, you know, and I come back and I find the towel and there it is, a little wrinkled, but it's hanging on the peg again. Finally, I take the towel, man, and I shove it into a waste paper basket, and I dump all the cigarette butts and ashes on top of it, and I come back, and the towel is hanging there again. Trying to get rid of that towel is like trying to get rid of a puppy. Finally, I get mad, and I drop kick it out into the hall, and the chambermaid catches it, and she says, "Oh, you Americanos, always fun and games." Finally, folks, I did the only thing I could. I went out, and I bought a dozen towels on the black market. You know what kind of an idiot you feel like sneaking towels into a hotel? Fellow travelers. And then they were stolen. By the maid. You know, and I would love to watch Americans overseas, because we're beautiful overseas, man. Like, we're the only people who can go into Naples' best restaurant. Now, Naples where they invented the pizza, right? So they ought to know how it's made, right? And you're sitting there in a restaurant, and you hear that flat American accent saying to the Italian waiter, "I don't like that pizza the way you make it. I want it maybe with more tomatoes on it, like back home." And that Italian man is crushing an Italian in the plate, and the knuckles are white, right? We are the only race of people, man, who can walk into an Italian store wearing a straw hat, a Hawaiian shirt, a pair of walking shorts, flat shoes, hanging 9 Japanese cameras around our neck, and when the guy says Americano, we say, "How did you recognize me?" And the only people over there who speak great English are the kids. They're marvelous, man, because they play that little game with you. You know, as you walk out of the hotel, a little kid will walk up to you like this with a limp, you know, and you say, "Hey, senor, may I have 5,000 lira? I was wounded in the war." The kid is 5. Of course, his sister's using the same line, but she's doing a lot better. And man, what I liked was the waiters, because they were great, because they like fat people, man, and they put on so much weight on me. Oh, man. Like, I gained all that weight. I gained it in Italy, man. The Italians couldn't have treated me worse if they had sandbagged me in an alley. Because everywhere I go, man, the waiter would be saying, "Mangia, mangia," and there I was, the big pig going, "Aah." And then when I started to get fat, man, I'm hanging out like to there, right? And the waiters love to rub your stomach. They come over and they say, "Ah, bello. Magnifico, estupendo." And I would say, "Sono gravidante. I am pregnant." And they'd say, "Incredibile. Impossibile." And I'd say, "Cinque bianchi bambini. 5 white babies." Managgia. Oh, I had fun, man. They were great to me. The waiters, man, they were always rubbing my face, you know, and they'd look at me and they'd say, "E bello, nero viso," blackface. In America, I'd be picketing. Still, I know it's love, right? Great people, man, warm and friendly. And Italian men, to me, are the kindest men in the world. Because, you know, to me, kindness is seeing a 330-pound woman in a miniskirt, and as she goes by, you say, "Hey, bella cosa." She looks like an elephant walking through the high grass. Do you know there's one area of American life that is almost totally segregated? And that area is an area in which we only represent 1.9% of the activity in that area. And it's a disgrace because we make up 15 to 20% of the population. And that area is nonviolent crime. Now, in violent crime, we're doing all right. But in nonviolent
crime, that's where all the white people are, because that's where the money is. And trying to crack that is tougher than trying to get into your country club. I mean, how many of you have ever heard of a Negro stealing $4 million, embezzling it from a savings and loan association? Never. You ever hear of a Negro convicted of $500,000 in tax evasion? Hell no. Most of the time, they owe us, and we too stupid to file a return to collect our money. I mean, how do you think it makes me feel to know that my race, Norwegian, places last in embezzling and tax evasion? I mean, in the tax evasion, we were a full 10 points lower than the Irish. And that's before they got a chance to include Senator Dodd. I mean, it's disgraceful the amount of activity that we have going for us in that area. You know, for example, fake art masterpieces. I read where some Texas oil millionaire bought $500,000 in fake art masterpieces. Now I figure if a Texan is going to get swindled, it ought to be by a Negro. Equal opportunity. The closest we get to fake art masterpieces is stealing an 8x10 glossy of Myrna Loy from the Five and Dime. And Roy Wilkins and them have got it all screwed up. They're trying to get us a fair shake in the PTA. But where we really need help is in the mafia. The heck with building better highways for better Negro marchers. We got to fight to get the Negro his fair share of those crooked contracts that build those highways. Let me hear you say amen. Amen. That's where it's at. What's more important, to integrate a lousy playground or to make $100,000 selling them a couple of cheap jungle gyms and a teeter-totter? I mean, have you ever heard of a Negro doctoring up the ledges and running off to South America? Yet white people are doing that so often, Pan Am had to add 30 extra flights. Even in those extra zeros, that's black power. I tell you, friends, you know, and you know what's idiotic is the fact that, for example, you take a crime like counterfeiting. That's an all-white crime. Just once, I would feel a sense of pride if a colored brother walked up to me and laid a counterfeit one on me with a picture of Booker T on it. To hell with George. I mean, and, you know, and that poor Negro holdup, man, has got it tough because he's stupid. He's not making any money.
He can't afford to take a cab to work. Got to take the bus. Got to stand there in that damp alley catching rheumatism, suffocating because he got his wife's stocking pulled over his face.
To hit you in the head for $4. And the only way we're going to get more Negroes into nonviolent crime, I think, is by busing. The only way. See, what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna run a bus up from the Wall Street area of Manhattan, run it up to Harlem, and on that bus I'm gonna put some trainees. I mean, some promising guys, some intelligent, well-groomed, clear-eyed liquor store hold-up men, car thieves and cat burglars. And I'm gonna run them down to the Wall Street district for a lecture series. You know, by people who can inspire them, like Florida land salesmen, Midtown parking lot operators, maybe a Teamster local treasurer. We'll even bring in Bobby Baker, maybe, for celebrity status. I mean, the possibilities are limitless, man. We'll even put out a magazine, a cross between Ebony and Business Week. With inspirational stories like how I got my $4 million tax refund on my 3-acre share crop. We can really work at this, folks. I mean, because it doesn't make sense to have a Negro in the Supreme Court if we don't commit crimes classy enough to get us up there. We got to stop stealing hubcaps and steal the industrial secrets that produce those hubcaps. And soon we'll have true equality with our white brother, because soon we'll no longer be 1.9. We'll move up to 5%, 10%, and eventually we won't be worrying about getting a Negro on the moon or in the White House. Eventually we'll have our first Negro nonviolent criminal in his rightful place, sweating out extradition in Brazil. Amen. I get carried away, you know, that's that old Baptist spirit in me. That's how the marches start, you know. Yeah. Let's march, all of us, yeah. You'll be out in the middle of a casino, you say, what the hell are we marching for? I don't know. The guy said, march, I marched. Oh, boy. I get carried away.
Oh, I'm going to give you some Negro history I must recognize. The fact that if you learn our history, you'll learn a lot more about us, be able to respect us a lot more. For example, are you aware of the fact that Negroes are responsible for the naming of the sauce that we now call Worcestershire sauce? It's an important contribution. Yeah, you doubt, right? I shall tell you. Now, many years ago, this sauce had no name. It was just called black sauce, no pun intended. And it was named one night by a Negro gentleman who strode into a restaurant, ordered a plate of beans, and the waiter brought over this black sauce, which the Negro gentleman had never seen before. And he picked up the bottle, and the Negro said to the waiter, Worcestershire sauce! See that? You don't know your history. That's in the McGraw-Hill textbooks. The revised edition. Another thing, do you know that we're responsible for the naming of the town that they call Yuma, Arizona? That was named by us. Yuma, for many years, had no name. It was also famous in that they had no guns in the town. And it was named one afternoon by a Negro cowboy who strode into town wearing guns, walked into the saloon, and the sheriff, almost as a reflexive action, whipped out his pistols and shot the Negro cowboy. And as the Negro cowboy lay dying on the floor, he rushed over to me and said, I'm sorry I shot you, but I'm just not used to seeing other men with guns on. I'm sorry that you would die here in a town without even a name. Maybe before you expire, you would like to name this town. And the Negro cowboy leaned up off of his deathbed and he said, Yuma. Don't tell me my show's on educational. What a significant contribution, Dave. Of course, I must also recognize my responsibility as a Negro leader. Negro leader being defined as anybody with $5 in a suit.
No, it's true. Do you know, anytime a riot breaks out, they find me. They call me. I could be under a rock in southern New Guinea. And they call me, and the first thing they say, Mr. Cambridge, what those colored people want? You know, when Watts broke out, I was in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Now, they got about six of us in the whole state. And the phone rings at 4 a.m. and some idiot says to me, Mr. Cambridge, this is KLAC, Los Angeles. Those colored people are rioting. What do they want? I said, don't ask me. There ain't no colored people here. I said, fool, you got Negroes running up and down in front of your doorway. Stop one of them and ask them. I said, I don't see nobody here but some Indians. And if they get evil, I'm gonna blame you. Tell you about that $24 for Manhattan. You know, I tell them about that. But it's wild, you know, Negro leader, you know. So I must therefore define for you black power. Now, I define black power in a rather circuitous manner by saying that when I first came to work in this town, Las Vegas, everybody told me never to mention Frank Sinatra in my act because he was probably the most powerful man in show business. And I said, no, he was not. I know he's powerful, particularly now that he's president of the Italian Anti-Defamation League. Which is the NAACP with guns. But he's not the most powerful man in show business, because I'll tell you this, when he married Mia Farrow, he tried with all of his infinite power to break her contract with 20th Century Fox, and he failed. Now, if I had married Mia Farrow, that's black power. And I'm gonna throw another one on you. What does that button say, sir?
Yellow power.
So put your right hand with my black hand and let's be frightened to death of those goddamn Chinese. Because if we start counting Chinese tonight, we'll be up to our behinds in Chinese. And you know, I've changed all my thinking about Chinese, man, because the way the Red China is acting, man, I'm trying to get next to all Chinese people now. Oh, man, there's a lot of them, baby. Do you know I fired my white laundry man last week? I went back to the Chinese hand laundry, yeah. That cat who lost 13 of my Hathaway shirts. He said, I lose his shirt. I said, that's all right, baby, don't worry about it. So black and yellow together. I said, yeah, because if they come over here, man, you know, because Genghis Khan was not only a great general, he was Chinese, you know. And if they come over here, I want that Chinaman to hold up that flat iron like the cross and say, no touching, nicey cully fella. Oh, man, I've gotten over all my hostilities towards Chinese. But do you ever feel hostile when you go into a Chinese restaurant and you go in and the guy gives you a menu written in English, right? And there's a Chinese menu written in Chinese on the wall. Do you ever feel a little hostile because you feel like you ordered an 8-course meal for 4 people, cost you $56, and there's a Chinese family over here eating the same thing, cost them 16 cents a piece? You ever get that feeling? I mean an authentic Chinese restaurants. I mean a place, for example, where only Chinese truck drivers eat. You see them, you know, you go and you see the Chinese laundry trucks out front. That's it, you know. Before I go, let me tell you a little story about Vietnam. Has to do with LBJ is in a hospital in Da Nang passing out Purple Hearts. And he comes upon this GI covered from head to foot in a cast, and he's trying to find some place to hang the Purple Heart, you see. And he walks over to him and he says, "Son, I know this is a tough and difficult war." He said, "I appreciate your sacrifice for your country." He says, "I know it's difficult. I bet you sometimes you can't even tell a Viet Cong from a Vietnamese." He says, "Matter of fact, son, how do you tell a Viet Cong from a Vietnamese?" He said, "Well, sir, generally I'm walking down the road carrying my M16 rifle, and I spot an Oriental chap up ahead with black silk pajamas, sampan hat, and I yell out, 'Ho Chi Minh is a mother!'" And if he goes, "Choo-choo-choo-choo," that's him. I said, "Well, son, that seems rather precarious to me." He said, "Just how did you sustain your particular injury?" He said, "Well, sir, I was walking down the road carrying my M16 rifle, and I spotted that Oriental chap up ahead with the black silk pajamas, sampan hat, and I yelled out, 'Ho Chi Minh is a mother!' And he yelled out, 'LBJ is a mother!' And while we were shaking hands in the middle of the road, a tank knocked us both down." Thank you, God love you, good night.